Hello and welcome to another episode of Consumer, the European podcast of the Consumer Choice Center. As always, I'm your host, Bill Wirtz, this week joined again by Fabio Fernandez, my co-host based in Italy. Fabio, how's it going?
Hello, everyone. Happy to be here again.
And of course, as always, you'll hear Billy Joel's Pressure still fading out in the background. Fabio is joining me here on the episode of November 4, 2021. And this week we have three topics lined out for you. We'll be talking about the EU-Taiwan relations, maybe trade, maybe diplomatic. What does it mean for our relationship with China? We'll also be talking about the EU budget for 2022. Looking up for all the money that the European politicians are willing to spend and how much we think it actually can affect the lives of consumers. And of course, we'll be talking about agriculture as well, the farm to fork strategy. New impact assessments have been coming out, and I think it'll be very interesting to talk about those and the overall effect that it has on consumer prices and availability of food. So, Fabio, EU-Taiwan relations, you've been involved in also lining out the program for today. You've pointed to this press release by the European Parliament, I think, when it comes to our relationships with Taiwan or Chinese Taipei, depending on who you ask or who you intending to please. Any thoughts that you have right away from the attempt to ease relationships, have a closer relationship with the island?
Yeah, so Bill, I think that the EU is doing a great job, and we usually talk here on the podcast about all the things that the EU is doing wrong. And I think this is one of the things that we need to praise the European Union, especially the MEPs that are trying to push a stronger relationship between the European Union and Taiwan.
Taiwan is a like-minded partner with whom Europe shares many common values. In a region where this is not always a given, in light of Taiwan's robust democracy and technologically advanced economy, it is crucial that the EU and Taiwan pursue a comprehensive and enhanced partnership that underpins the rules-based order.
And we know that especially after Biden was elected, we know that the United States have been having some problems internally in terms of economic, also all the Afghanistan thing. And they are kind of leaving a blank space or a space in the international diplomatic scenario that China and Russia are very much interested in filling. And Taiwan has been the center of this because China has been putting some pressure, especially in the Taiwan Strait. And the fact that the European Union now is trying to push to make those relationships, especially economic relationships with Taiwan, stronger is really pissing China because they are really not happy about the developments that the European Union is going on the Taiwan relation.
Yeah, I remember when we had the great stable genius of Donald Trump as U.S. president. I think wasn't he congratulated by somebody in Taiwan, whoever's the governor or prime minister? And then he called back, which was actually in breach of diplomatic protocol because, well, the United States does not officially recognize Taiwan as an independent nation, even though it does things that wouldn't make sense otherwise, like parking an aircraft carrier between one part of China and another part of China. But so there's been some ups and downs there. I think it still remains to be seen as for the Biden administration, like how involved the US will be in those kinds of conversations and whether Taiwan is actually kind of a start World War III kind of scenario is hard to tell until it actually happens. I think what you rightfully say there is that the European Union has a great potential of playing in that game, and I think the EU as an economic factor really has a strong emphasis there. The problem is, of course, like how do we deal with the Chinese reaction towards that? Because there's so many products we want and need from China. We want close relationships for a very long time now. The European Union has been negotiating of some sorts with China to avoid some of the retaliatory tariffs that we've had. It's hard, and the problem with China is that, you know, China, there's not a transparent kind of regime. It's not like you can see inside the political parties. There's only one, and it's hard to say where the conversation goes there. Where do you think we should kind of tilt the balance between, like, what are we willing to accept of Chinese retaliation when it comes to trade, and how strong of a line do we actually need to drive here?
Yeah, I'm not sure how things are going to develop in this area. The only thing that I know for sure is that the European Union is drawing the line in the sand. And this is very important because China, as I said, likes to push the boundaries a little bit further every time. So if you leave a gap space, they're going to fill that space with diplomatic pressures, their economic influence. They're always trying to fill the gaps. And Taiwan is very important, not only for the European Union, but for global trade. So the fact that the MEPs are trying to lay the ground for a new bilateral investment agreement with Taiwan is very honorable, in the sense that more investment and more EU money attached with businesses, enterprises in Taiwan makes us more fixed and more concerned about what's happening between the relationship with China and Taiwan. And some numbers for the listeners, probably some of them don't know much about the relationship between the EU and Taiwan, but Taiwan trade with the European Union as per 2018 was 50 billion euros, and Taiwan produces over 50% of all semiconductors. So everything that we do in terms of consumer electronics, smartphones, computers, televisions, all those products need semiconductors, and Taiwan produces over 50% of all semiconductors in the world. And Taiwan also produces other products that the European Union is very interested in, especially the MEPs that are pushing for this stronger relationship with Taiwan. And those are telecommunication products, because they are worried about 5G, consumer electronics, as I said, and also medical and healthcare equipment. And so for the European Union to try to strengthen this relationship is very positive. And I see a great outcome in terms of this relationship for European consumers, of having more products available, better prices, and also to fulfill and be sure that we're going to have all those products available, even if something happens. As you said, the other side of this equation is how China is going to respond to that, because China, as I said, is not happy. And there are many statements that came out after this statement from the European Union, talking about how China is not happy, how things are developing.
Yeah, and very nationalistic approach that they take. You know, it's not just the economic arguments that they take. It's not just a commercial perspective. This is very much like a pride approach that China takes. Like, this is the island. From every reasonable perspective, Taiwan is an independent country. It's run like an independent country. It issues, it's got its own flags, and even has, to some degree, diplomatic relationships. There's no doubt about it that Taiwan is independent, but of course China pretends otherwise. It is also interesting to, I think, in our approach when we target the reaction of China, is that we consider ourselves here as well as consumers, because the European Union is not, we're not just dependents of the production levels of China. We are consumers of the Chinese market, and as a consumer, you have a certain power and a certain power and diversity. Just there's more than just one market you can buy from. India is an emerging market that is incredibly interesting to do commerce with, and we can pick and choose our battles here when we choose to buy something. But I also think that, and I wanted to also get your take on this, is which individual responsibility do consumers have? Because I hope this doesn't diverge too much from the topic, but you've seen this in the State of the Union of von der Leyen, is that the somewhat questionable ways in which some of our products are produced in China also demands not just, in my opinion, some corporate responsibility from the retailers and the people who buy the products, but also as consumers, that we ask the question and that we want to know, under which conditions were our products produced? If we get our products from Taiwan and South Korea, we have some sort of an understanding as to which standards exist for the labor market, for production levels in those countries. But with China, it's really hard to tell, because there's really no transparency whatsoever. So in your view, to what degree, as an individual consumer, do you think that we also bear some responsibility into informing ourselves, like, where our products come from? Where did I get my cheap, I don't know, microphone foam or wherever? Is that something that you think as consumers we have a responsibility in?
Oh, absolutely. I think so. I think I do have a responsibility when I choose a product that is produced in the ways that I believe that should be produced, and products that I don't know how it's produced, or if there's any labor that it's not validated, or any labor that it's forced. And we have many stories about that in China. So consumers play a major role in that, but also consumers like cheap products, and China offers really cheap products. So I think consumers have this issue of trying to understand what are the main important things that for them to consume a product that is responsible or responsibly produced, and getting a good price for the product that they are looking for. And this is always going to be the issue, especially with China, as you said, because it's a communist country, authoritarian country, so you don't have this transparency to see how things are produced. But every month, or at least every couple of months, we have some scandal with Nike, with other brands, that you see that they have some kind of production issue in China. So consumers have to be more conscious, and I think they are getting more conscious about that. But they have a hard choice to make, which is, should I stand by my beliefs, or should I have access to cheaper, good products?
Yeah, and not just about the products, the way they produce, but also the ramifications of the technological ramifications. We talk a lot about cybersecurity, and if people want to buy a Huawei phone, that's fine. I personally, I wouldn't feel entirely comfortable doing that, and I would feel more comfortable with a Samsung phone from South Korea, because I do have questions about the fact that some of these companies in China, and this is also something that we wouldn't have that we don't have if we have economic relationships with Taiwan, is that there's a Communist Party office in the major companies in China. And that is also something that is, it feels so surreal. It feels like, pre-Berlin Wall style level, but it's something that is very real in China today. And of course, there's no real bargaining there that we can do with China. We're not going to invade and change those rules, but it's about some of the choices that we make to that extent. So I think it's good that we raised EU-Taiwan relations. I hope that's not just going to be a press release that the European Parliament puts out and then doesn't follow up on it. I really hope that there's going to be more exchange between the two sides. Next topic, though, Fabio. Also on the issue of spending money, which we do like to do a lot of in the European Union, that is the budget. The budget, for those of the listeners who don't know, we in the European Union, we have a 7-year cycle for the budgets. So that means that every 7 years we have an entire conversation with new prime ministers and new heads of state and government about what is going to be the 7-year cycle. And then within that 7-year, there can be distributions as to how the budget exactly is used. So the last one was 1.8 trillion. So 1.1 trillion of that is the regular European Union budget, and 750 billion of that was the EU recovery fund. So that's precisely for the coronavirus recovery. Those 750 billion, by the way, are a loan. So this is the biggest loan probably ever taken out by any government institutions ever. And we don't know exactly how that's going to be paid back, because the European Union has suggested that some of it should be paid back with specific taxes, one of which now exists already since the 1st of January 2021. That is the tax on plastic packaging, which is something we've been addressed on the podcast already as well. But it seems that we still are in the standard modes of trying to spend ourselves out of these crises. This is, it feels very flashback compared to the last the financial crisis that we had, where we try to spend ourselves out of it. And to me, and I'm not sure how you see it, Fabio, but to me, it's just, we seem to be as ill prepared as when we spend our way out of the problem last time. And just 10 years later, we find ourselves with as unstable government institutions as we were last crisis around.
Yeah, I agree with you. Government debt all around the world is rising. So the United States also is having this conversation right now about increasing debt. So it is a problem in the sense that government doesn't create anything. The only source of income that they have is taxes. So that means they have to increase taxes, or they have to make their way to, at the end of the day, have the budget with the money that they have available to spend. And the curious thing here is that the budget is set for next year is 171.8 billion euros. And the European Union, or more specific, the European Parliament, wants to boost investments to tackle the side effects of the pandemic. And as you said, they are trying to put more money as they did in the past. But this is something that the central bank, the European Central Bank, is very focused on. They really believe that spending more money is going to bring back the economic growth that they hope to achieve inside the European Union. But for me, the most interesting thing is that the MEPs also actually reversed most cuts that were made by the Council. So the Council actually cut 1.4 billion euros for next year's budget, but the MEPs, they reversed everything and they got that to the level that they want it to be. So they also they are spending more money. And the areas that they are spending more money is for research. So if you, I don't know if you remember the Horizon Europe, which is a program about research. So they increased that, they increased the budget for next year in 305 million euros for the Connecting Europe Sustainability Transport, which is basically investing more in railroads, 207 million euros more. The Erasmus program, which we receive 137 million euros more, and they also increase humanitarian aid, specifically for Afghanistan, in 20%. But when you see all those items in the budget for next year, I ask myself what those spendings are actually going to going to tackle the problem, which is unemployment and growth. I don't see how investing in research, which doesn't create more jobs in small and medium companies that are the backbone of the European economy. I don't see how investing more in the Erasmus program is going to create more jobs. So I really don't understand how all those things are going to achieve the goal of basically reducing unemployment and driving more economic growth. And if you read the proposal, it's basically about the European Green Deal. So they're investing everything to make Europe more sustainable and everything related to European Green Deal. We're going to talk about in the next topic about the Farm to Fork strategy, which is part of this great revival or renew of Europe, they are calling. But I would like to know also your thoughts on that, because for me, when I looked at the proposal, I don't see how those spendings are going to actually achieve the goals that they are proposing to.
I mean, there's quite a few things to unpack here. I think what coronavirus has shown is that all the research grants that we've given out to government institutions and in terms to the medicines agencies and so on have been fairly ineffective in actually solving or addressing this crisis. If you look at the actors that actually worked towards trying to solve this crisis, every vaccine, the medical equipment, the research going into medicines to help patients that actually get COVID-19, it's all private industry. It's all private industry. And I think the effective tool that we've been using for a very long time already is tax exempting research and development for private companies. And that has shown itself to be way more efficient than all the government institutions. And as opposed to taking that as a lesson, what the European Union tries to do is having these conversations about, oh, we were so dependent on this crisis because for 1 or 2 months we didn't have certain products. So we need to increase our production of medicines in Europe. We need to have our government organized medicines productions facilities and all of that. So it's again, it's like, well, we haven't learned anything from this crisis. So I agree with you. I think research and development organized by government doesn't actually create the growth that they're trying to look for. And the fact what you point out about the European Green Deal is also true. You would think to some extent that when it comes to the European Green Deal, it would give us some pause. The fact that a lot of people have lost their jobs, purchasing power is considerably going down with inflation. We have really high gas prices right now here in the Netherlands. It's I think 5 times the prices of last year. And then even in April and May 2020, this is as early of the stage of the crisis as it goes, you hear people from the European Commission goes like, well, I know that some would claim that we need to take a step back, but actually we need to double down because the climate crisis is even more important than ever. And if you look at the coverage in the news media as well, the coverage in the news media compare the COP 26 coverage with the coverage of those who protest the fact that they can't afford everyday goods anymore and they can't afford their rent anymore. That's actual consumers arguing that they have real life problems right now, but everybody is focused on whatever Greta's new speech is. So I think there's a lot of problems there. I think what is also interesting to know for the listeners about the EU budget is that, as I explained before, this is a 7-year budget. So every year you can decide as to how to spend the money. But if you spend too much in 1 year and then this accumulates, eventually you'll run out of money by the end of the 7-year period. And what happens regularly in these periods is that at the end, when they run out, they ask the individual member states to band together and then to fund some of these programs individually. So if you think that the 1.8 trillion that was decided not too long ago is that's the end of the story. No, by the end of the period was a 2022, so by 2027, I think we're just gonna have individual member states still you, the taxpayer, picking up the bill. And that's usually the net contributors anyway. So that's Germany, the Netherlands, I think France is even a net contributor as well. So Luxembourg, some of these countries will have to pick up the tab for that too. So it's the problem is that it is actually emphasized in the European Union, a problem that we have in the member states. So in the member states, the problem is that a government, the politicians want to be reelected. So they say, okay, so by the end of, towards the end of the term, we start giving out goodies. Here, there's some extra pension money. Here, there's some extra goodies here and there. We're spending money. By the way, we're calling it investments, even though it's actually just government spending. That's a good framing that they do there. And then they try and get reelected. The problem in the European Union is that the budget has to be used so that in each individual member state where people want to get re-elected, they can spend money. But you have an election in Germany. You had an election in Germany this year. You'll have an election in France next year. Everybody has elections all the time. So you continuously have to spend and you have to slap the logo on that this is EU funded. So it's really a downward spiral. It really doesn't stop.
Yes, and it sounds to me that they are pushing the great reset idea. So this is like the opportunity for them to do the great reset. So reset on agriculture, reset on how we produce energy, reset on everything that they believe it's wrong in terms of economy, in terms of social issues. And they are trying to put that into this bill, into this budget, and not actually focus on the problem that is going to solve people's lives, but also consumer issues that we usually talk about here on the podcast. The only thing I can praise about this is that they have two lines actually talking about how they're going to spend more money on small and medium enterprises, which I believe is a good thing because it's actually backing the backbone of Europe in terms of economy, and also how they're going to improve the single market. So those are two commitments that they are trying to do, and I respect that. We still need to see what those commitments are going to be in terms of tactics, in terms of implementation, and see what they are going to do on those two things. But focusing on small and medium enterprises and also focusing on improving the single market so we have more products floating from different countries inside the EU, I think that's a good thing, not only for growing the economy, but also for consumers.
Just one more thing on the what you mentioned, the Great Reset. I think it's been interesting that, you know, there's been also some conspiracy theories floating around that statement. But I think what the World Economic Forum, when they put out the Great Reset statement, I'm not exactly sure if it was a position paper or something. My view on this is that how great if it was actually a Great Reset, because I remember the old PCs, when you pressed reset, you know what happened? The computer started from scratch completely, you know, you went back up. But that's not exactly what the governments are doing. A Great Reset would mean that we actually reconsider the entire notion of how we do things. But we're not doing a Great Reset whatsoever. It's just about doubling down on the policies they've been using before. So we're phasing out nuclear energy and then renewables don't work. So we invest more in gas and then gas prices go up because we didn't do storage well. So like it's just using more of taxpayer money to do the things that weren't working earlier. In a way, I'd love a Great Reset. I would love to rethink the entire structure of how the government is trying to get investments into new technologies and job growth and so on. But it's actually just the old formulas. So I would love for them actually taking their titles at their word. We're taking the titles at their word. We are also going to talk about the farm to fork strategy. This is the third topic we wanted to address today, Fabio. And Farm to Fork, I've said it a lot of times on the podcast, but if you're a first-time listener, Farm to Fork is basically the European Commission's roadmap for innovating agriculture, making it more sustainable and environmentally friendly. In order to do that, it does quite a few things that don't really make sense within the realm of environmentally friendly food safety and food security. So, for instance, it tries to phase out half of all the used pesticides by 2030, and also wants to upgrade organic production to 25%. Right now, we're about 7-8% in the European Union in terms of what people actually consume. So even though we know that organic actually has like a higher carbon dioxide emissions output, so there's a lot of things here that are going to be discussed and a lot of legislative proposals. What I think is interesting is that still the European Commission has not actually released a viable impact assessment. So that means we still don't exactly know what this means for consumers. However, there are impact assessments done by other people, and the USDA did an impact assessment which they found that production levels can go down by up to 4%, but then prices can increase by up to 89%. And then Wageningen University in the Netherlands, they did a study not too long ago where they found that between 10 and 20% agricultural productivity would be reduced. And that's really the last thing we want in Europe, is for agricultural productivity to be reduced, especially now. And this is something that we've talked about last time we were co-hosting, is that this has an effect on inflation. This affects the purchasing power of consumers, right, Fabio?
Absolutely, yeah. And they don't have the assessment yet, but they have the recommendations. So they want to have more EU science-based recommendations for healthy diets. So they want to decide what is going to be a healthy diet and decide what you're going to eat. They're also setting the maximum intake levels because they're worried about overconsumption of meat. So they want to not to be able to get meat. And they're going to do that by making the prices more expensive. They want to tackle down on processed foods with high salt, sugar, fat. And as you said, they are trying to tackle about pesticides protection, especially because they want to protect pollinators. And you can talk more about that, but pollinators are not actually in danger in Europe. So they have a lot of recommendations, but without the assessment and without understanding what it's going to be, or what are the actual problems, first of all, and then what are going to be the impacts of those measures, how they are going to decide and do recommendations without understanding the full picture.
I mean, the pollinators thing, you would think that some people have upgraded their talking points in a while, because the entire conversation on the bee apocalypse, the bees are dying, that's so 2012 when that story came out. So what people did is that some people looked at the pollinator decline in some areas in the world, including in Europe. And what we found when we looked at those numbers is that to some extent, it was because the local beekeepers, so the hobby beekeepers, were not actually keeping track correctly. And also, we didn't have a good enough sample of those bees. Now, beehive populations can actually also decline in certain regions, but that can be cyclical and so completely natural, or because of viruses that are also completely natural. But what people did is, when they saw those numbers at first, first, they blamed GMOs. This is a while ago. First, it was GMOs that caused it, until some people reminded them that GMOs are actually not really largely available in the European Union. And also, there's no link whatsoever scientifically between the use of GMOs and a reduction in bee populations. And then they started blaming pesticides. And that's where the politicians have gotten stuck on, even though we also know that is not a reason for population declines. And by the way, again, we don't have population declines. Bee populations are actually going up across the world. So we get stuck on old talking points. And it's one of those unfortunate things where it's been in the news so much that even like the Brussels bubble media, they even call it bee-harming pesticides. And that kind of sticks with people. And there's really very little you can do about this at one point, because people have this so ingrained in their psyche that this is a problem. And unfortunately, what we'll be doing is phasing out products that we need so that our food is available and healthy. And I think that in the long run will affect everything. And it's not just about making individual products more expensive now because they think it's unhealthy, like meat. But it's also in the long run, as we have less availability of those products, they will get more expensive. France had a huge problem when they phased out neonicotinoid pesticides, because beet farmers in I think, 2019 or 2020, basically said, hey, we'll have to start importing sugar beet because we don't have enough production. And then what France did was that they said, oh, yeah, this ban on this pesticide, we'll be phasing that out for 3 years. So for 3 years, you can use it again, which is the exact omission that you needed this crop protection tool in the first place. So a lot of accumulations of bad ideas. And I think one thing that I've raised a few times in this podcast, and, you know, I'm pretty sure you have also more to say about this, is what Frans Timmermans said last year in the European Parliament when he was talking about the farm to fork strategy, is that he said, we've gotten used to food being too cheap. This is May 2020. We've gotten used to being food being too cheap. And that to me is so tone deaf for a person who makes a fortune working at the European Commission.
I think this is this should be an opportunity for our agricultural sector to also look at its own resilience and at its own sustainability. And I believe that one of the Achilles heels of the way we consume food and foodstuff is that we've gotten used to everything being very, very cheap. And I honestly believe that if there is a reevaluation and health gets a bigger priority, then the willingness to pay a bit more for better foodstuffs might increase.
And you were talking about how they like to market or at least to rebrand some of those ideas and make that more popular with the audience. And the actually slogan for the Farm to Fork is, it will make our food healthier and more sustainable. And the important part about the Farm to Fork is not about food healthy or making food healthier, it's about more sustainable. Because if you look into the suggestions that they have and all that is inside this project, you have the greenhouse emissions, you have animal welfare, you have organic farming. So we have a lot of things that are much more related to tackling some of the sustainability issues that they believe are causing the problems with the planet than actually tackling making food healthier and also making food more available. So I agree 100% with you in that. The problem in the EU is not that food is not available, because food is available, but you have certain regions that those type of foods are available. So when you think about the European Union as a single market, you don't have a single market for food, basically, because you have some types of foods that are available in some regions of the European Union, but not everywhere. And that changes and fluctuates with price. So if you have or if you want some specific food that it's not available, for example, for me here in Italy, I pay a fortune for that specific vegetable or fruit. And it's not about... So the problem here that we have to address is making food more available and not more or healthier. We need, of course, good food that is healthy and has good quality, but we need to make food more available and cheap. That's what consumers want.
It's not just about the idea that the inherent foods, though, need to be healthier for people to end up with a healthier diet. I mean, ultimately, we also have to have some understanding that people have some responsibility for their own diets. And you need to have a healthy mix of a diet and exercise. And what the government tries to, the EU's approach to all of this is that at the macro level, at the government institutional level, if we regulate the prices of some of these goods, what we're going to do is that people end up healthier. But that's not exactly how it works. Actually, our calorie intake hasn't increased that much in the last few decades, but our exercise levels have considerably gone down. And actually, you can offset a certain consumption. If I look at my sister does CrossFit at an incredible level. Like I would never do that, but she gets up really early. She does CrossFit. She can eat anything she wants. She can really eat anything she wants. And that's great. And if people realize that there's a healthy mix where you need to decide between what do I eat and how do I exercise, and all of that is a factor. Right now, if you just increase the price of meat, what you do is that the low income households cannot afford it anymore. And what they do is that they even downgrade on the quality even more as a result of an increase in prices, which is what we've seen when they tried it in Denmark with the fat tax. And everybody else just said, like, okay, well, I have to just spend a bit more money to get meat, and that's about it. So that's just an additional tax where it just ends up being revenue for the government, but no actual health effects whatsoever. And then in 10 years, when we figure out that none of these measures have worked in any way, what they're going to do is not reassess the measures. They're just going to double down and double the tax or triple the tax and so on. So it's an infinite loop.
Yeah, and one thing that research shows is that when you increase the prices of vegetables, fruits, grains, and even meat, consumers usually go for more processed foods because those are cheaper. So if you want to have a healthy diet and if you want people in the European Union to eat healthy, driving the prices of all those things down is the way to go, and making food more available is the way to go.
Absolutely, Fabio. I think this is the end of our time here on the Consumer Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today. Just remind people of where they can follow you on Twitter.
Yeah, they can follow me on De Faria e Silva, which is my middle name. But you can also go to the Consumer Choice C, and we have all retweets, everything that we do, we have also in the Consumer Choice C. Channel.
Wonderful. And if you would like to support this podcast, you can do that on consumerchoicecenter.org/donate. There you can buy us a coffee or support in general the work that we do here at the Consumer Choice Center. Thank you so much for listening, and see you Thursday.
You have to learn to pace yourself. Pressure. You're just like everybody else. Pressure. You've only